I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Imagine a learning city where everything, literally everything, is turned into an opportunity to teach something new, and all day, every day is considered a teachable moment. Kevin Crowley is director of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Learning in Out-of-School Environments, and he and his team have been working on turning the urban environment into one big classroom. We'll talk to Kevin about his work today on Smart City. Also with us is Ken Hughes, whose blueprint for Santa Fe's sustainability is becoming a model for cities around the world. That's today on Smart City, but first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Kevin Crowley is director of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Learning in Out-of-School Environments, or Up Close. He's also an associate professor of education and psychology. Students at Up Close work with community partners, including the Carnegie Museum of Natural History, the Mattress Factory, the Warhol Museum, and the Children's Museum of Pittsburgh, to help them think about how visitors use, talk about, and learn from their exhibitions. Kevin, how does learning outside of a school setting differ from the learning that takes place in the school?
Outside of school, learning happens everywhere all the time. And it's often happening in places like parks, places like museums, when you're playing games, maybe on your computer. And it happens in situations where you don't particularly believe that you went there to learn. It happens in situations that you choose from your free choice. So there's no curriculum, no institution, no teacher who's keeping you at the lesson. And it happens in ways that are really on the learner's own terms. You don't encounter a moment of, you know, science learning in the everyday world. You may get interested in a bug, or you may see a dinosaur in a museum, and you make sense of that in everyday terms according to your own interest, your own background knowledge. So the challenge, if we're going to design out-of-school learning, is to think about how to take all of these moments, which are maybe not even coded in the learner's mind as learning about art or science, for instance, and patch together a broader curriculum, a broader way for that person to help that person understand the discipline through all of these multiple encounters that are across, you know, space and across time.
How would you begin to do that?
The way that you begin to do that is you have to work to develop an infrastructure of experiences that surround people where they can bump up against art and bump up against science as often as possible during the day. Some of that are going to be places like museums. Some of that are going to be ways of bringing educational messages to everyday experience, maybe, you know, putting up signs in an amusement park or something, which is something we've tried here in Pittsburgh. And thinking about what are the threads that you're hoping learners will follow across place and across time? How do you want to present science to them? That's a conversation that requires really the entire community to think about what its resources are and how it could begin to coordinate a message about something it cares about, like art or science.
I love this idea, and had actually talked once to an attractions designer for Disney about turning the city into an attraction. Most of our listeners might think that's a horrible thought, but turning them into, in effect, learning attractions. How could you, in effect, turn the city inside out as a learning experience? Have you thought about that? Have you tested it? Tell me what your reaction to that idea is.
I think it's a fantastic idea. I mean, we know from the learning sciences that people don't learn particularly complex ideas quickly. They require practice. They have to rehearse themselves as people who know how to think, know how to learn, know how to talk about really hard content. And so really the most powerful out-of-school educational model would be to turn someone's environment, someone's city, into a learning laboratory. What that requires is that you're not building kind of really school-like moments, because people don't really want to be in school, and it doesn't work to take them out of their everyday activity and tell them, you know what, now we're going to do a lesson. So what we've experimented here in Pittsburgh in a collaboration between the University of Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon, and Family Communications, an idea we called Explanatoids. And we went around the city doing different installations about content, essentially The idea was to put little yellow sticky notes all over the city that would remind people that if they wanted to, they could talk about science in a bunch of different venues. And we designed signs for people standing in line at the amusement park that focused, for instance, on the physics of roller coasters, or while they were standing in line at the log flume ride, you know, that one where the log goes down and it splashes.
Mm-hmm.
We had a series of signs that encouraged people to come up with hypotheses and make arguments about who in the log would get the wettest. We've worked at the professional baseball stadium here. The Pittsburgh Pirates let us put some spots up on their Jumbotron that focused on the science of baseball. We've worked in the public parks. And the idea of these explanatoids, you know, part of what, if you want to turn the city into a learning attraction, you're not ever delivering a complete school-like explanation. It's impossible in 30 seconds on a Jumbotron to really explain the physics of a fastball, for instance. But what you can do, and the way to make best use of those moments, is to give people little seeds of conversation, things that they could pick up, that they could really use the environment to help them structure a conversation, in this case about science. We were interested in science because we were funded by the National Science Foundation. And these little seeds are supposed to, the design challenge for us was to figure out what are the things about this environment, what are the conversations that people want to have anyway. So at the roller coaster, people talk a lot about where they want to sit and are they going to be scared. So we thought about what is the science in those situations, went through a series of prototyping and developed signs that would deliver just a seed that would start that conversation and give them a little bit of science to integrate into it if they wanted to. And so the model is to get the city talking, get it talking about science. And as people wander around the city and see these explanatoids, if it becomes a habit, if you know that you can turn to your environment and have a conversation about science or art whenever you wanted to, then maybe we'd have a hope of getting people more involved every day in science.
Do you know what people actually learned during these experiments?
Sure. We've been very serious throughout in evaluating the outcome of these experiences. And our model was to start a conversation. So the first thing we measured in all of these moments was whether or not people talked. And that wasn't always a really easy thing to do. It's really difficult, actually, to conduct learning research in a place like an amusement park or at PNC Park when the Pirates are playing. The idea there was this was a collaborative project where a senior design studio at Carnegie Mellon and a graduate course on learning science at the University of Pittsburgh, the students worked together to develop 30-second spots that were run 15 minutes before the first pitch on the Jumbotron during every Pirates home game. And the spots covered things like the physics of a fastball or why it is that people cheer at sporting events. And to evaluate their effectiveness, what we really wanted to know is, were people seeing the spots? Were they getting any of the knowledge out of them? And then were they using that knowledge in a conversation? And so to evaluate that, we had a team of 15 students who would show up at the stadium about an hour before the game and hand out little 3x5 index cards in the parking lot to visitors that told them that these science spots would be on, and if they brought the card to us during the game, we would give them some gifts at guest services. And so people took these cards from us, and we staffed guest services throughout the game. And the Pirates were really wonderful to us. They gave us all sorts of leftover swag, you know, bobblehead dolls and lunchboxes and stuff like that. And people would show up throughout the game, and we'd ask them a series of questions, essentially figuring out, did you see the spot? What did you think the spot was about? Did you talk about it? And did you extend in any way that conversation beyond what was just presented to you on the Jumbotron? And we found that, in fact, the spots had been fairly successful. The people who showed up had generally seen the spot, understood what the message had been, and quite a few of them, I think about a third of them, integrated that message into their experience and extended that beyond. So if there was a spot on fastballs, for instance, they also talked about the physics of a slider.
Is it necessary then to couple this out-of-school learning with in-school learning?
I think the tension between out-of-school and in-school learning, it's traditionally defined how people in out-of-school learning have viewed themselves. for a while, they saw themselves very much as an anecdote to what was wrong with schools. So rather than being teacher-directed, out-of-school learning was going to be kid-centered. Rather than having a curriculum, it was going to be built on the interest of the people who wanted to participate. And I think there are some challenges in the out-of-school learning realm that are actually much more complicated than what schools set out to do. I don't think anyone decides to become an artist or a scientist or a historian because they had a really fantastic class on it in high school. I think most of what gets us connected to the disciplines and keeps us passionate about learning over the lifespan are our experiences with disciplines in out-of-school settings. And I think the way to think about school and out-of-school is that they ought to refer to each other. It would be crazy to have a kid wandering around the world and have a completely different view of science out of school than he does in school, which is unfortunately often what we do today. So they should refer to each other, but I don't think that they should see themselves as necessarily the same or connected. I think right now in the informal learning world, we have a tremendous need for new theory about how people learn about content and develop deep ideas about content over the lifespan. So we can't rely on schools to let us know what science ought to look like or art ought to look like in a place like a museum, for instance. We really need to get out into the world and figure out what is the best way to conceptualize that learning, what is the best set of practices to build environments, build experiences where people can engage with that, and then what are the ways that we can evaluate whether that's successful. And we're just right now, it's the Wild West in informal learning. People are just beginning to grapple with those ideas seriously.
Did the city of Pittsburgh ever pick up on what you were doing and think, we could turn this into a real asset for our city? We could make this city a learning lab.
One of the wonderful things about Pittsburgh is it's a city that takes partnerships really seriously. And a lot of the local foundations have been very proactive in encouraging institutions to partner with each other and to really learn from those and share their lessons. And so I think, you know, our project was one of many examples in Pittsburgh where people have taken very seriously the notion that we can't leave the job of education, informal or formal, in the hands of any one group of people. One of the challenges, I think, in out-of-school learning has been to simultaneously try to understand what the curriculum should look like, what it is that people ought to be thinking about in something like art or science, how we could design environments that support that, and how we could tell whether or not we've been successful. And what that requires is really a deep partnership model. And at Up Close, which is the center I run at the University of Pittsburgh, all of our projects are built around very serious partnerships with people who develop learning environments. And our first really deep partner in that way was the Children's Museum of Pittsburgh. And for about 10 years now, we've been working together with them to simultaneously try to figure out what is out-of-school learning, how could we build more powerful environments to support people in it, how would we know if we were successful. So we have a laboratory built right into the new Children's Museum, and the researchers from Up Close participate in the design teams in the museum. They work with the education staff at the museum. And simultaneously, we've been really pushing each other, the museum and the university, to really deepen our ideas of what it is we thought we were doing. So when we first showed up at the museum, you know, we thought we knew how families ought to talk about art. And I think they also felt they knew, for instance, how they ought to design exhibits to help families talk about art. But in the 10 years we've been working with them, we've really had to struggle to make explicit a lot of our implicit beliefs about what learning is, what a powerful art experience would be, the role of parents in a place like a museum. And we've made a lot of progress. I think when we started, we had a very didactic notion that parents would be doing a lot of teaching. The Children's Museum had a very constructivist notion that parents would be stepping back and children would be able to discover all they needed to know in the museum. And in our work, particularly focusing on how signs can enrich conversation and activity in the museum, we've really come into a middle ground. We've discovered the idea of parents really more as people who may be a direct target of a lot of museum education in a children's museum, they're standing there wondering, what is it that they could do to help their children encounter something like science or art? And they don't necessarily know a lot about the topic. They don't necessarily know a lot about how to support or extend kids' exploration. So we've been really struggling with the idea of how it is that parents could, you know, go shoulder to shoulder with kids, and the environment would engage each of them as the learners they are and find ways for them to work together more productively, to talk about the content in ways that are interesting and that might stick and last for more than just the museum visit.
I love the Children's Museum of Pittsburgh. It's a fabulously designed building. I love Jane Warner. She's a marvelous leader of that museum. And yet, sometimes when I go to many children's museums, it appears that people are just grazing. They're sort of looking, they're pushing buttons. Maybe they're reading, maybe they're running, but it doesn't appear that learning is taking place. So what are the signs that actual learning is taking place?
Oh, that's a great question. If you want to look for learning in a place like a children's museum, look for moments where parents and children, or children and children, are stopping and talking about something that just happened. There is, as you say, a lot of grazing in a children's museum, a lot of running around, a lot of pushing buttons. It's easy to design environments where kids can be entertained. And it's really hard to design environments where that engagement is around them developing an idea or changing their mind about something or noticing something interesting about the world. And, you know, they're kids. Basically, most of their world they experience in the company of other people, of other children, of their parents. And I think the best learning that could occur in a place like a children's museum is when the family can rehearse itself as people who know how to learn together. They find out what they're interested in. They find out how they respond to situations where they don't know the answer or where people in the family have two different ideas about what might be going on. And I think that's really the mission of museums. They're kind of talk factories. They're places where you can design experiences that help people talk about content. And I think that's the kind of learning you should look for on the floor of a museum.
What makes a powerful learning environment?
Learning environments, I think you mentioned kind of Disney early on, and they're fantastic at designing environments that engage and kind of sustain interest, but they don't design environments that do a fantastic job at learning. That's not what they're about. But that's the beginning. A good learning environment is an environment where people can get connected, interested, engaged in content. But in order for it to result in any sort of meaningful learning, it also has to be an environment that allows for them to talk about what's going on. So there needs to be, very simply, space in the learning environment for people to gather, to note things, to discuss what they're seeing in front of them. It has to be an environment that allows them to explore more deeply. Probably it's best to have a lot of grazing in a place like a museum, but when people decide they want to dock somewhere and dive more deeply, the environment has to find ways to give them support. If they're interested in content, they can't necessarily come in as an expert and just find ways to tell those stories in a museum. The museum has to help them with the content. There's a lot of exciting stuff with technology that I think you'll see increasingly on the floors of museums in the next decade that'll help people do that.
I wanted to ask you about technology. Tell me what you think the role of digital technologies are in learning.
Digital technologies provide something unique and valuable. Part of the hardest part in out-of-school learning is to find ways to tie very separate moments of experience and learning together. So if you encounter dinosaur bones at a museum and then a week later you're reading something on dinosaurs, it's really hard for kids to put those experiences together and make inferences about what they might mean and get to some bigger ideas about science, for instance. But what technology allows you to do is to move information, get it just in time in a series of learning environments. And so the kinds of things that I think will be most useful are ways that technology is going to let us stitch together moments to kind of annotate our world as we go. And have access to that information at later points. There's a ton of people who are thinking about doing that with cell phones, with iPods, with all sorts of stuff you stuff in your pocket, that you'd be able to wander around the world and perhaps encounter messages that have been left there for you to find, or send messages to your friends which refer to similar experiences. So there's a lot of mixed reality opportunities that people are exploring. The other big thing that people are looking at is digital gaming and complete virtual worlds. And that set of technologies, I think, we're just beginning to understand how powerful they might be as an engine for learning. And those are completely unique. You can't take on the persona, for instance, of a city designer and learn about urban planning and learn perhaps about statistics and probability without an engine like SimCity. Only technology allows you to do that.
John Seely Brown and Doug Thomas have written a number of interesting papers on the role of play in learning. Taking it out of the digital world, Kevin, are there things about the play spaces we provide for children that we should redesign or do differently in order to enable children to have a better play experience and perhaps a better learning experience out of that play?
One of the mistakes we make in designing play environments is we have a really outdated notion of what's developmentally appropriate. And a lot of people who are educators are kind of trained on very outdated notions of Piaget, for instance, that claim kids are not able to think symbolically until a certain age. But what we're finding both in research and in cutting-edge practice is that play doesn't have to be stripped of hard content. It doesn't have to be for kids only. The notion that you could, for instance, play with science or play with art or play with history and encounter some deeper ideas in the context of that is something that we're just now beginning to design and think about. So I think, you know, old versions of play have really focused on play as engagement, but we haven't really thought about what it would mean to play with the content yet. We're just beginning to understand how we might break the world up that way and design experiences for that. We've done a lot of work with the Carnegie Museum of Natural History looking at how it is that families talk about dinosaurs when they visit. It's a fantastic dinosaur collection at the Carnegie, and they're just now expanding their dinosaur hall, and we've been working with them to help conceptualize how it is that the signage and the education in the hall would support visitor conversations. And one of the ideas that we've discovered is we're calling it islands of expertise. If you look at your typical five-year-old, they don't really know much about the world, and they're not really able to grapple with complex ideas in domains that they're not that familiar with. But if you think about, probably many people have met a five-year-old who's a dino expert, right? He's one of these kids who's read 10 books about dinosaurs. He knows the names of 20 dinosaurs. He knows way more than his parents do about dinosaurs. And he's still a five-year-old. He still has the mind of a five-year-old, but because he has a lot of powerful knowledge, he knows technical names, he's read about theories, he has all of a sudden some examples that he can use for reasoning. And these kids, these five-year-old dino experts, are able to be very sophisticated on notions of evolution, of extinction, of form and function relationships. And it was really the knowledge that gave them that power. And I think that knowledge wasn't in a school. The kids got that knowledge by playing with dinosaurs, by reading what they wanted to read, by visiting museums. And that idea that play is a place where kids pursue interest, and sometimes in doing that, they develop these extraordinary islands of expertise, is an idea that I think we haven't recognized very widely in childhood. We would still say, I mean, the common answer would be that all five-year-olds would have a similar experience in Dinosaur Hall, and they would be unable to do anything very advanced. But a five-year-old comes in as a dino expert, he's ready to be challenged. He's ready to be pushed by the environment to really start engaging in some big ideas. And that, I think, is one of the tremendous frontiers in understanding play and understanding informal learning, is figuring out how we could have environments that could work for a five-year-old who knows nothing about dinosaurs, but also work for a five-year-old who comes in as an expert and is ready to be pushed, is wanting to be pushed. And play creates, you know, a million islands. There's kids who love horses. There's kids who love bugs. There's kids who love dinosaurs. And the informal infrastructure has done a terrible job of giving them something meaningful to do with that knowledge.
I love your work, Kevin. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Sure.
Kevin Crowley is director of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Learning in Out-of-School Environments. After a short break, we'll talk with Ken Hughes about a sustainability blueprint for Santa Fe, New Mexico. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation and the Memphis Regional Chamber, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Once a month on Smart City, we bring you news from planetizen.com about urban planning, design, and development. Here's Nate Berg.
In an effort to reduce traffic, cities across the globe are considering charging drivers to enter their most congested areas. Cities like London have already implemented congestion pricing, which imposes a daily fee on drivers who enter certain high-traffic parts of the city. The New York Times reports that environmental and community groups in New York are pushing to impose congestion pricing in Lower Manhattan during the busiest times of the day. The plan was originally proposed a year ago, and despite a rejection from Mayor Michael Bloomberg, proponents have regained momentum. Meanwhile, in Stockholm, Sweden, a discontinued congestion pricing system is on the verge of being reintroduced. The proposal plans to appease drivers by using the proceeds to fund highway improvement. And in London, the city looks to build on the congestion pricing system it established in 2003, often cited as one of the best in the world. London's mayor, Ken Livingstone, has proposed increasing the flat 8-pound-a-day rate up to 25 pounds for highly polluting cars. The cleanest burning cars, on the other hand, would be allowed to travel for free. And another traffic reduction experiment is currently being tested in various cities in Denmark, Scandinavia, and Britain, to surprisingly successful results. Der Spiegel magazine reports that a new method of removing road signs, traffic signals, and guardrails, and letting cars, bikes, and pedestrians mix freely, has shown improved safety records and cross-city travel times. The restriction-free transportation system is intended to increase attentiveness in drivers and to require a more humane interaction between drivers and pedestrians based on eye contact and friendly gestures. And in China, plans have been approved and construction has begun to expand Beijing's subway into the world's most extensive metro system, according to China Daily, eventually covering more than 350 miles on 19 different lines. The length of the system is expected to surpass that of London's underground system by 2020. Three lines currently under construction are expected to be operational when the city hosts the 2008 Olympic Games. In New Orleans, rebuilding slowly continues after the devastation of last year's hurricanes Katrina and Rita. But as the city plans to demolish more than 5,000 units of its low-income housing developments to make way for new urbanist projects, local housing advocates and residents have challenged the plan in federal court. The New York Times reports that low-income residents in New Orleans fear being pushed out of the city by the newer, mixed-income developments. In contrast to typical low-income American housing projects built grossly out of scale, housing advocates argue that the New Orleans developments are some of the finest examples of low-income housing built in the country, and that they don't need replacement. A new trend developing in the world of planning is placing increased importance on the consideration of children during the planning process. A recent conference in Sydney, Australia, looked at ways to make cities and urban places more child-friendly. Speakers at the conference said that by planning cities to cater more to children, effects such as depression, criminal behavior, and obesity can be minimized. A recent article in Metropolis magazine also highlighted the importance of creating inclusive places like parks and playgrounds, for children and families in urban areas as a method of improving a city's safety. And finally, results from a new study fly in the face of the common perception that suburbs are socially alienating. A report released by the University of California at Irvine concludes that suburban areas are actually less socially isolating than dense urban areas. According to the study, the chances of people talking and interacting with their neighbors increases by 10% for every 10% decrease in population density. Jan Breuchner, the UC Irvine professor who led the study, says that while most of the criticisms against suburban sprawl remain accurate, at least one is no longer valid. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. Ken Hughes is author of Flow's Blueprint for Santa Fe. He's a member of the Sierra Club's Building Healthy Communities Committee and a Knight Fellow in Community Building at the University of Miami. Ken is chief planner for the state of New Mexico's Department of Finance and Administration. Ken, summarize the major flows that you document in your new report, Flow's Blueprint for Santa Fe.
Carol, there are five flows or basic human needs that I address in this essay that I wrote to address global warming. First one is water and the basic human need of drinking, but also having it around us in the air and on the ground and in the water, in the river, I should say. Second is energy, which is a major, major issue here, obviously. The third is mobility, how we get around. And the fourth is food, what we eat and how we grow what we eat and how we get it to our plates. And the fifth is what I call conversation, how we interact with each other.
How is each flow a factor in global warming?
Well, as I said, the biggest is energy, and we need that to heat and cool our buildings and our industries and our transportation means that are fossil fuel-based. And unless we have a handle on that, we don't have much chance of combating global warming. And that's the number one issue. But also transportation, obviously, how we get around is a major factor. Surprisingly, food is another one. 20%, it's estimated, of all the energy used in the United States is used to grow and distribute the far-flung food sources. A typical cracker, for instance, takes 4,000 miles to get from the wheat field to our plates.
It surprised me a little that you included conversation. Tell me more about what that means to you as it relates to global warming.
I included that because I could have used the word land use, but I wanted to make it more dramatic in the fact that unless we are able to connect with each other and get out of our individual lifestyles, I really think that is a major impediment to realizing that we are all in this together and we need to have honest conversations among each other, and there's no better place to do that than in shared spaces that we can arrange. And we've had 5,000 years of human history of doing just that through places like plazas and courthouse squares. We've lost that history. I know those of us in New Urbanism are trying to recreate that. But what that does is to create the conversation to realize that we can do things better. If we share conversations, we might be willing to share walls. We might be able to share lives. There's a young archaeologist who's been working at Chaco Canyon here in New Mexico. She was postulating what happened really to the demise of the Chacoans. And she thinks it wasn't the drought that did them in. She thinks it was social stratification. I think there's a lot to be learned from that.
There is a lot to be learned from that. Ken, how do you imagine this blueprint being used? Did you intend it as a local document for government, for civic leaders, for business, or was your intent to develop something that would be emulated by other cities? Who do you imagine the user to be? Who are you trying to influence?
Well, I wrote it in with shamelessly in mind with upcoming local elections last year in Santa Fe, and tried to interest those who are running for mayor and running for city council. In fact, it has been presented to who's the current mayor and current city councilors. And the hope is that they will take the messages embedded in the essay and try to put those into policy, into practice, and into the financing structures that are needed to pay for the needed improvements, the needed changes in our infrastructure and in our transportation systems. And right now we're working with councilors and the mayor to change the building codes. Santa Fe has joined many hundreds of communities around the country who've pledged to the Cool Cities campaign, and Santa Fe has also pledged to embark on what's called the 2030 Challenge, which means carbon neutral by 2030.
Now, explain that so our listeners will understand. It's a significant challenge.
Sure, it's a significant challenge. However, it's very doable. That's what's interesting. The challenge has been laid out by Ed Masriel. He actually lives here in Santa Fe, a local architect, and he has said that you can meet at least half your changes in building energy use through design. Very simple things, very low cost or no cost in some cases. Then the next step is to use solar and rooftops. And, Carol, you'd be surprised that even in Seattle, there's 16 times more solar energy falling on the roof in the south facade than is needed for a typical household. And here in Santa Fe, it's 26 times more because we're in the desert southwest. There is an amazing amount of solar energy available. And if you devote one quarter of your rooftop to solar for heat, hot water, and electricity, that'll take care of all those needs. So that is what he's seen as a second step. And then if you can't meet it that way, then you buy it from other sources. So you agree to pay to your utility a little extra so that they will commit to buying more wind power. So those three methods can get to not only half the energy use, but by 2030 make it carbon neutral.
And you also mentioned that Santa Fe is part of the Cool Cities Initiative. Talk about that as well.
That is an initiative that we at the Sierra Club, where I'm active, and also the U.S. Council of Mayors have jointly come up with out of an initiative by the mayor of Seattle, Mayor Nichols, to honor Kyoto. Given the lack of ability to pass anything in Washington, the mayors are taking upon themselves to do this one city at a time. How they meet that Kyoto and beyond, because frankly that won't be enough, is up to each unique circumstance in each city.
You just said something, more transit is in the offing, it has to be. And yet you know and I know the money that goes into roads, as an example, to support a car culture versus the money that goes into transit in this country is extremely unbalanced and favors the automobile. U.S. Conference of Mayors, as part of its Cool Cities Initiative, has it in fact taken a position on, let's say, transit funding as it compares to highway funding? Just one example of what you say is necessary to combat global warming.
I think they probably have done that, Carol, and make a strong case for more transit funding from the federal level. Yeah, another thing I addressed in my blueprint is how to finance things like transit. I'm all for trying to find more money from federal and state sources, but ultimately I think local folks have to pay for things locally. And whether it's a combination of things like general obligation bonds, using tax increment financing to pay for transit. Even a real estate transfer tax lends itself to that. The niftiest idea I've heard about is called the Transportation Utility District, and that's been done in one place in California where they take the old handbook of transportation engineers and figure out how many trips are generated per land use, which from households to businesses, and that would assess fees according to how many that demands. So the major big box retail would be assessed the most. I think there's some justice there.
I was very impressed that you, in fact, included recommendations for how to pay for these things. And I was, too, most struck by your advocacy of the Transportation Utility District, because it was something that I had certainly not heard of. And apparently, this is something brand new?
I think it is. And it seems to make a lot of eminent sense that you charge those who generate the most traffic, motor vehicle traffic, and you can turn it around and use it to offer some alternatives. We need to look at five different ways to get around, not just by private vehicles, but shared vehicles, the zip car movement, and even taxis. Transit, obviously, is a major important, whether it's by bus or rail, biking, and then down to the essence of walking. If we have neighborhoods that are complete, they have to have walkable sidewalks, not poles in the middle or too narrow, but where two people can walk and share the conversation again and look at the interesting places as they walk along.
Let me come back to your five flows: water, mobility, energy, food, and conversation. Is there any one flow that's more promising in meeting the challenge of global warming than the others? In other words, is there a hierarchy here?
Carol, it has to be energy. I mean, energy in the building sector, that's where we have a lot of promise. And if we can get a handle on amending our building codes, go to a performance-based code. Say, look, by 2012, this city is going to have as a requirement that you're going to only have a budget, an energy budget for your building, 50% less than the current conventional use of energy in those buildings, and then ratchet it up from there. The U.S. Green Building Council just last week has adopted this challenge. So the fact that three-quarters of buildings by 2030 are either going to be new or remodeled, there's a huge potential, Carol, in with this change in the building codes to make or break the very livability of the planet. I don't think that's overstated.
Are enough people trained, are enough architects, enough planners, enough building code inspectors? I mean, do we have enough people today who believe that global warming is a reality and who are schooled in the technologies and the methods that can mitigate the ill effects?
Oh, by no means do we have enough people into that field. But that's one that, again, we need to get busy making that happen. There'll be a challenge to architecture and design students next February 18th, 2007, throughout the nation to have a one-day teach-in to get people concerned and committed and get our young folks realizing that their future is going to be miserable, frankly, if they're lucky, without major changes in how we build our cities. And they need to be at the forefront in making sure that that's not going to be the case.
Tell me, when you look back through this report, what is the most significant observation that you made? Is there a big aha in here?
I think it's a series of them, Carol. I wouldn't point to one specific thing. I try to make it practical, because when you look at the issue, you can come away with a feeling of despair or blind faith that we'll figure out how to muddle through or actually do something. And I try to be practical and list a variety of things that together might be able to make a difference at a local setting. Last Saturday, we had a little workshop here in Santa Fe of trying to design a sustainable neighborhood. And many of the ideas that I had, other people shared. I didn't bring them up. It was very fascinating to see people say, oh, we need a trolley here. We need community gardens. We need to fill in, line these parking lots with retail on the first floor and housing above. And these are all ideas I had in the report, of course, but they brought them up. So these aren't copyright by any stretch. And it's just great to hear other people say them as well.
I'm also curious, Ken, how you think about framing the actions that government needs to take, that business needs to take, that developers and citizens need to take. I mean, it can be overwhelming at times, but again, how you sort of stratify that and help people understand at an individual level where they can have the most leverage. You said it earlier, it's easy to look at some of what's happening and some of what seems to need to be done and either despair or blind faith. I love the way you put it. So how do you convey to people that sense of where to begin at all levels?
There are different levels that people can work in, and we need to work at as many as possible. I like to see when people take individual action. You know, I try to do that myself, biking to work. We adopted kids instead of having our own, putting solar in a house, building a house, passive solar in the first place. But that's not enough. I think individual action will not solve this problem. It's too huge. It's too, if we did it that way, it's insurmountable. We need public policies, and we need the policies that will affect the business decisions that people will make. And that's where we need to take the ideas and move them forward. The grassroots support for these ideas to then have a parade that the leaders will then start to jump in on. And I don't blame them. They won't lead a parade without people there. And that's our job as activists to make that happen so that the signals are set from the public sector to the private sector. Look, we want you to have carbon neutral buildings ultimately. Figure it out. We're not going to tell you how to do that. And then that leaves an amazing amount of creativity that the new design for buildings and our communities and our neighborhoods can be led by the private sector with the public policies in place.
So you're asking the public sector to set really goals or outcomes, expected outcomes, but you can achieve them in creative ways that we haven't thought of.
Sure. So when you come in for a permit to develop, that they will take these into account and show us how you plan to make your neighborhood carbon neutral.
Can you end your report with these tests of our actions? And I love the test that you suggest. Tell us about them.
That came out of the conversations you and I were blessed with the Knight Fellowships, and we had a few emails going back and forth about someone brought up the tricycle test. Yeah, that was by Enrique Peñalosa, the former mayor of Bogota, Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about that and how he wanted a three-year-old in any neighborhood in Bogota to get around happily on a tricycle as his test of the good life. Then up from there, they talked about the tricycle test, where any seven-year-old could happily skip, bike, or hop to the store and back. And does a neighborhood accommodate that thing that you and I took advantage of as a kid that thought nothing of it? Now, how many neighborhoods have that? Not very many. So we need to figure out how we can meet that test again of the tricycle test, popsicle test, I'm sorry. And then, let's say between 12 and up, the smooch test, where are those places of the heart?
10. What'd you say, 12? 12 and up?
Well,
okay,
we have to
Ken.
Be realistic, Carol. You know?
The kids in Santa Fe are more advanced, but okay. The smooch test.
Where are those places of the heart, those landscapes that people love and want to treasure the rest of their lives? And we need to keep those in place, literally. The fourth is the elderly test. Well, how can our senior citizens actively stay engaged even as they are not able to drive anymore or should not drive as much and yet have so much to contribute? And the final test is collective memory. Talked about Chaco, but where are we going to have a legacy? And as it relates to global warming, how are we going to leave our kids and grandkids a planet that's not fit to live in? Or are we going to actually say, well, no, we can't live the way we are living anymore. We got to change, not for the worse, but change in a lifestyles that can be sustainable.
Well, I think those are very appropriate tests, and I would advocate codifying those into every city code and making sure that what we build, in fact, meets all of those tests. I appreciate, Ken, the work you've done on Flo's Blueprint for Santa Fe. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
You're welcome, Carol.
Ken Hughes is author of Flo's Blueprint for Santa Fe. Flip open a copy of any personal magazine on the newsstand and you'll find plenty of articles on retirement planning. City View's commentator Walker Smith reminds us that when we are planning for retirement, it's important to remain involved with the community, both socially and economically.
My father will celebrate his 84th birthday this year. He's been careful and lucky over the years with his health, so he still has a lot of vigor and energy, which he puts to use. Every day he goes to the office and puts in a full day's work. People are always stunned by this. And he's not just shuffling papers. He sells insurance, so he's always driving to meet prospects and close sales. His days can be just as long as they ever were, but my father keeps at it, even in his 84th year. Not that everyone should emulate my father, of course. Few of us will make it to his age with that stamina and endurance, and even if we do, even fewer of us will want to commit our time and energy to a full-time job. But my father is an inspiration to me. His commitment to earning a living, to paying his own way, to making a contribution for as long as he has the ability to do so, is the example I want to follow. When I'm that old, I want that kind of vigor and enthusiasm for the hustle and bustle of everyday life. My father was the first thing that came to my mind when a few years ago I read about the results of a survey among college seniors in which 77% said they fully expected to be millionaires in their lifetimes and 61% said they expected to retire between 40 and 50. Now, if my father is at one extreme, these college seniors are at the other. I applaud their desire to succeed, but even as I do, I suspect that beneath this desire to succeed in life is an even deeper desire to secede from life, which is to say, make a killing and then make an escape. Some people I know refer to the amount of money they need to do this as their quote-unquote checkout amount. That is, the amount they need in order to be able to check out. This disengagement from a more communal life is worrisome because we can't live without these talented people. This lotto mentality is corrosive and ultimately self-defeating. We must find ways to encourage the best and brightest among us to contribute the full measure of their talents to our communities. Fortunately, self-interest can work as our ally. After all, communities are as necessary to isolated lifestyles as they are to fully absorbed lifestyles. Rich people depend upon others no less than anyone else, if only to pilot their planes or clean their pools or manicure their lawns. If the moving parts of communities don't check out, then there won't be any checkout for people with lots of money either. But we need everyone, not just a few, to contribute. Communities need people like my father, people committed to making a continuing contribution, not gaming for a way out. There can never be too many people like my father, people who aspire to nothing more and to nothing less than continuing to put in a full day's work. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders dedicated to speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.